Support for The Exchange podcast comes from you, our listeners, and from McLean Middleton, New Hampshire's largest law firm. For over 100 years, they've been committed to their clients, community, and colleagues. Locations in Manchester, Portsmouth, and Concord, New Hampshire, and Woburn and Boston, Massachusetts. Learn more at McLean.com.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. When it comes to the college application process, our guests today say, ignore the rankings, forget the consultants, and set aside the notion that there's one perfect school for you. We're talking this hour with the co-authors of a new book, The Truth About College Admission, a family guide to getting in and staying together. They urge readers to view this process as a positive experience of growth and self-discovery, instead of a grim game that you win by checking all the right boxes. Today in The Exchange, a new roadmap for college admissions. Let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Comment on Facebook, tweet us, or call in 1-800-892-6477. Both co-authors join us this hour. Joining us from Atlanta is Rick Clark, Director of Undergraduate Admissions at the Georgia Institute of Technology. And Rick, a big welcome. Thanks for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
And joining me in studio, Brennan Barnard, the other co-author, Director of College Counseling at the Derryfield School and U.S. Performance Academy. Brennan's also College Admissions Program Manager for the Harvard Graduate School of Education's Making Caring Common Project. And Brennan, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Laura. Thanks for having us.
So both of you, you've been in this field for a long time. Brennan, more on the high school end. Rick, on the college admissions end. To you first, Brennan, what's one aspect of the way many people approach this process that just makes you crazy, that just, you know, you just want to go, no, stop?
Yeah, it's just the fact that it has to be this slog, right? It's something I have to endure or get through, and that it has to be something that's overwhelming. I mean, this is a really exciting time. This is a time to be thinking about the opportunities ahead and who you are and what you want. And it ends up being this perception that this has to be this stressful, kind of anxiety-producing experience that, you know, you just need to
endure,
make it through. Yeah.
So instead of groaning, we should cheer?
Right. Exactly.
What do you think, Rick? What's the one thing about this whole experience that, you know, day after day, you just find yourself shaking your head and saying, it doesn't have to be this way?
Right. Gosh, I mean, it's hard to limit it down to just
right. One.
But what comes to mind for me is, regardless of where you live, we all somewhat have a myopic understanding of all the options and choices that are out there. So we have one of the greatest strengths of our, you know, landscape of higher education in America is there are so many different choices. And I think people get very, narrow in how they view that. And so whether, you know, you're in the Northeast or down here in the Southeast or somewhere else around the country, you've heard about these schools, you've seen them, let's say, play sports on TV, or parents went there, or that's where kids from your school always go. And people forget about all the choices and options. And that continues really all through this experience. And I would hope, and one of the goals of the book really is to help people see a bigger picture.
Yeah, Brennan's talked a lot about that too on this show, Rick, so I'd love a little more from you. The idea that people get so focused on a handful of schools when there are so many awesome schools in this country. So go ahead, Rick.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it's not always just the ones that are ranked the highest. I mean, you know, maybe it's here again, take the, you know, southern part of the country, and you'll see kids that just apply to schools that are in the SEC, as an example. You know, and maybe in other parts of the country, it's only schools that are in the Ivy League or wherever it may be.
What's the SEC, Rick, by the way?
The Southeastern Conference,
okay.
Right? So schools like the University of Georgia or University of Alabama or Louisiana State, it's not always this trophy hunting for the most selective schools. But again, I think that, you know, and there's been studies done on this where if you talk to students and you just ask them, name 10 schools, and they do that, there's going to be your regionals, and then there's going to be the schools that everybody's kind of familiar with. When you say college, people say Harvard, or people say Yale, or whatever it may be. We have a naturally narrow framework. And what's ironic about that is kids are actually getting barraged by all these other schools constantly with, you know, again, the brochures and the emails, and yet somehow still they don't see all those choices or consider all those options. They stay on this, you know, small kind of tightrope. And I think that's what brings about some of the anxiety that Brennan was describing, is when you think there's only certain choices, then you feel like if you go off course, you're not going to lead to that particular place.
Go
Whereas
ahead, Brennan. Yeah.
I think if people looked bigger, there would be more of an option.
This is a big point for you, Brennan. We've talked about this before.
And I think Rick does a really good job, too, at unpacking some of the numbers around this. I mean, how many four-year colleges are there in the United States? How many universities and colleges overall? And then also around admit rates. We focus on the top, you know, 20 to 50 schools in the country. And when you look at it, the number of schools that have admit rates under 30% are just this minuscule amount.
And I find that very relieving.
Yeah.
That, you know, there's a lot of schools that have high, you know, admit rates of about 50%.
Right. And Rick, what's the number for Pac-12 schools, for example? What the average
like
admit rate is?
4% admit rate.
Yeah. Yes. They're taking almost three quarters of their students. They're applicants at like the Pac-12 schools.
And yet there's a sense among some kids that the schools with the lower admit rates, you know where I'm going with this, Brennan,
yeah,
that those are the schools that you really want to get into. Who wants to go to a school that admits 75% of its students?
Right. And, you know, there's a group out of California called Challenge Success that does some great work around this. They have this white paper called The Fit About College Rankings, A Fit About College Rankings. And it looks at the issue of engagement being more important than selectivity and rankings in college admission. So it's outcomes are and satisfaction in life and in college are more based on the way students are engaging rather than, you know, the selectivity of the college which they attend.
One expert in this field who reviewed your book praised it, saying it was badly needed because, quoting here, misinformation and a cacophony of noise about college admission are hurting students. To you first, Rick, please, how would you describe that misinformation and cacophony of noise? What does it sound like? Where does it come from?
Well, some of the misinformation, frankly, is coming from the mainstream media because, again, you know, rule one of journalism is if it bleeds, it leads. And so what's exciting or what's interesting to cover often in higher education is, you know, Stanford or Harvard who have this, you know, sub 10% admit rate. But as Brennan said, I mean, we're talking 50 schools in the country, I think, right now that are under like a 20% admit rate. So it's extremely small. Very, very few schools are in that. They're not really the guidepost, and they're more the anomaly, right, than the norm. And so that's the misinformation, is it's really hard to get into college. That's just not true. The average admit rate for four-year schools right now is 65%, the majority of schools taking the majority of applicants. And I think the cacophony of noise is, understandably, kids are getting hit early because they're in, let's say, a college-going school environment. They're from a family that values college and higher education. They have an aspiration. These are good things. And therefore, they're getting, you know, sort of pressured to think about college at such an early age that just crescendos as they get older and move into that junior and senior year. And so I think having people pause and ask bigger questions, which is really what we try to frame up in the book, is critical. Because if you never pause and reflect on questions like, why do I want to go anyway? And what's the purpose? And what are my goals? And how am I made? And who brings out the best in me? Then you start putting the cart before the horse and saying, where, instead of, you know, why, and those really important bigger questions that too few people really ask.
You know, it's so true. And when I was reading the book, Brennan, I thought these are conversations that you hear all the time when you are in a milieu of people who are, you know, have kids who are 15, 16, 17, 18. And the question to the young person always is, so, sophomore or junior, where are you thinking about going to school? No one ever says, why are you going to college?
Right, right. It's actually the first question I ask students when I sit down with them at Dairy Field. I say, first of all, do you want to go to college? And that's always kind of this, you know, they're sitting in the college counselor's office. And so it's kind of this no-brainer. But so often We find that students are kind of on that treadmill, right? They're in a college preparatory school. It's kind of assumed they're going to go to college, and they haven't really stopped to say, "Why am I doing this? You know, what am I in this for?" And so I do ask that question right at the get-go: why are you going to college? And some have a really thoughtful answer. Some, it kind of stops them in their tracks.
Which is good, because then it's
great.
An opportunity
to consider purpose and consider these really important questions.
So how does why, Brennan, lead to the best where?
Because it really helps a student think about the experience they want to have and what their goals are and what their values are, and then they can match that to a school that meets those same values and those same where they can have that experience and where they can achieve those goals. And not every student knows what they want and where they want to go and why they're doing what they're doing. But to consider those questions and consider them early is so important.
Yeah, you don't have to have the answer right away.
No.
But start unraveling question.
And
of
we
why.
Have, like at Dairy Field, we have this Pathways program that it has students thinking not just about college, but earlier on in high school about kind of who you are and what you want and what you value, and exposing you to experiences that might kind of open up opportunities to explore those questions. And so, when we start those questions just at the college process, sometimes it kind of stumps students because they haven't had time to think about those. So I'd really encourage families to think about those questions when students are early in high school about what kind of things are important to you.
Rick, how does why get you to the best possible where?
Yeah, I mean, I would concur with what Brennan said. And actually, as he was talking through that, I mean, it is, again, rare and critical. I also would add to it that it helps all through the process, because if you take the opportunity to really ask and write those things down and use this as a bit of a filter, then when people like me are buying your name and sending you all this glossy, shiny, happy, smiley kids, you can sort of filter that and say, you know what, looks great, I love the foliage, but this place just doesn't match up, right, with my why. And it also continues through. Now you get in and you're weighing your options. Well, come back to that touchstone. Why? All right, just because mom went there, just because it's ranked higher, just because it's a higher selectivity, is that really in line? All these, you know, the money starts to come in and you're weighing your financial options and not just your, you know, college options. That why is your touchstone from the point of where do I visit to where do I apply to where do I ultimately select. And I think that's so important because, you know, right now we're seeing a lot of students coming back for their second semester of their first year, and it's inevitable. It's winter. It's cold. They're coming back from being at home. And a lot of these kids are asking, like, did I make the right choice? Is this really the place for me? And that's happening all over the country. I think every person that's gone to college can relate to that one cold, dark night where they wondered, did I make the right decision? And I think there again, even as you're in college, you can come back to that why and say, no, I understand why. It's hard. I'm far from home. You know, it's kind of crappy weather right now. I'm sick of eating food from this place, but I know why I'm here. And that is really reassuring.
Again, our number here in the exchange for you to join us with questions about the college admissions process itself or stories about your own application, how it went, whether you got in, how you got rejected. We'd love to hear from you. Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can also use Facebook or Twitter. One more time, that email, exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are the co-authors of a brand new book called The Truth About College Admission, A Family Guide to Getting In and Staying Together. And gentlemen, I want to ask you about that second part of the title. Brennan, why is this book a family guide? What's the role of families in this process beyond, if they're able to, helping to pay for college?
Yeah, and I should say that we use that word family as kind of a catch-all for every circumstance.
Caring,
right?
Adults.
So, caring adults, right? A caregiver, a grandparent, a invested adult. But really that this doesn't have to be a singular pursuit, that this is done in community, looking for and matching to a good college that is a right match for students. because it's important to have those conversations about expectations that parents and family members have for students, and kind of parameters that families might have for where a student goes to college. Some families are very clear about the fact that a student's not going to go more than 3 hours from home and things like that. And so it really is this this opportunity of going to college can either bring a family together or can kind of divide them, right, and create what we talk about wedges in the book, about wedges that kind of are driven between family members, but it's parents and students when they're applying to college. And so that's, we really focus on family first in this book and how a family can stay together.
What about, Rick, students who don't have families who can help? They're first-generation students, or maybe they don't even really have, reliable adults in their lives. They want to take this path toward a four-year education, and that's what this book is largely focused on, but they really don't have that support around them. I just wonder what your experience is, Rick, with those students.
Absolutely. And, you know, we partner with a number of different organizations, and I say that specifically Georgia Tech, but, you know, a lot of colleges around the country, working with organizations, community-based organizations, CBOs that are out there who are either giving live in-person advice or even virtual advice. There's a one website to refer to would be collegepoint.info. This is inclusive of some of the kind of bigger and well-known groups like College Advising Corps or Scholar Match. They're supported by Bloomberg Philanthropies. Another great resource is Strive for College, omfirst.org. Those are a couple that come to mind. But if you have a listener, if you have someone out there who's trying to support a student, I would say a couple things. One, certainly, you know, being proactive and reaching out within the school to the counselor. But the truth is, one of the problems we have right now, especially in our public schools around the country, is extremely high counselor-student ratios. And this is an issue that a lot of folks in our industry and field are trying to advocate for, is to lower these ratios, because it has implications not only for college going, but for good financial matches and reducing debt and a lot of the issues people are focused on. But the nice thing about a lot of these organizations now is they're doing virtual advising as well as in-person advising and assisting students with helping them look for scholarships, giving them assistance on writing essays, et cetera. And so that would be what I would initially say about a student who might be in a situation like that, or an adult who has identified a student who has a lot of potential but doesn't have the support around them.
Yeah, Brent, I'd love your thoughts, too. We'll talk after the break about, again, families and some of the parents who, you guys write, jump in too much in this process. But what about those young people who would do well at a four-year school but don't have that family support sort of guiding them through?
Yeah, I mean, it's like Rick said, it's really kind of unconscionable. There's almost a 1 to 500 counselor to student ratio.
Wow.
Right. And they're not just working on college access. They're working on behavioral issues. They're working on mental health. They're working on course scheduling. Really everything. And so it's about having one invested adult in a student's life. And that really makes a difference.
All right. We will talk more after a short break, and we'll start taking your questions and comments. We got a lot of Facebook comments that I'd love to share with you. Our listeners wrote in. We asked, did you get rejected by your first choice college? How did that work out? We got some great stories, so I'll share those after a break. And we'd love your stories as well. Send them in by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest in You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, the co-authors of a new book called The Truth About College Admission, a family guide to getting in and staying together. And in it, they push back at common beliefs and practices and strongly urge parents to back off and let their kids own the process. We'd love to hear from you. What's one thing you wished you knew when you were applying to college? Or what's your advice to a young person who's going through this process right now? Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tweet us, comment on Facebook, or call 1-800-892-6477. And the co-authors are Brennan Barnard, Director of College Counseling at the Derryfield School, also College Admissions Program Manager for the Harvard Graduate School of Education's Making Caring Common Project. Joining us from Atlanta, Rick Clark, Director of Undergraduate Admissions at the Georgia Institute of Technology. And gentlemen, let's go right to our listeners. And Dan is calling from Lebanon. Hi, Dan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead.
So I'm fascinated with this conversation. My daughter is a senior this year at a state school. My curiosity is, I mean, these gentlemen, I think they're doing a great thing, and I enjoy listening to what they have to say. It seems to me, though, my question is, I wonder roughly what their financial background is. And then I was just listening in on your intro to this segment, and I found out one of them works at the Derryfield School and another one has something to do with Harvard.
No, and Georgia Tech is the other guest, yeah.
I'm sorry, my apologies, yes. But, you know, my daughter was an honor roll student through school, served on student council, was class representative, known she was going to college since kindergarten. However, our financial situation, even though I'm okay, it's almost impossible to get into a big name school, so to speak. So my daughter went to a state school, which is great, and we like it. But I wonder if these gentlemen really see that side of it on their day-to-day routine.
Dan, I really appreciate the call. And we've done many, many, many shows on paying for college. That's a part of this book. It's not the whole part, but it is part of it. And Rick, to you first, just remind us what the book says about, okay, once you get admitted, then the school says, this is how much it's going to cost. What sorts of conversations need to happen around that prior to admission and afterwards?
Sure. Well, first of all, certainly appreciate the caller, and also just listening to the weather report up there. I'm still a little bit cold, so I'm shivering at this answering this. But I would say, first of all, the book really speaks to exactly the caller's point, to say it is not about a certain set of schools. That, you know, we give a lot of data in there that says people focus a lot on those places. And yet if you look at, you know, retention rates, people need to ask different questions, right, about what is great, what makes a school of good value. And we talk a lot about, for instance, Frank Bruni's book, which is Where You Go Is Not Who You'll Be. We talk a lot about we give some data around schools that have high admit rates and also high retention rates. In other words, students that are there are succeeding academically because they're coming back. They're financially able to afford it because they're coming back. And theoretically, they're happy because they're coming back. And so we point people, in fact, to having the mentality that the caller was describing. But in terms of paying for college and the conversations around that, what we talk about is the earlier families can discuss money, the better. And, you know, before you even visit, or certainly before you apply, to say, listen, here's where we are. And I think a lot of families are not willing to be open and transparent with their kids about what they either can pay, or, you know, they're able to pay, or they are willing to pay. But if families, we give a couple different kind of filters. One of those is, you know, limitations, conditions, and expectations. In other words, listen, here's where we are financially. Let us help you understand the lifestyle we lead, that you understand kind of how we pay for life. And therefore, this is how college fits into that. Now, I am able to pay, perhaps, for this amount of money, but I'm not willing to because I want to retire before I'm 72, right? That's a fine limitation to put up, but you need to do it early before the kid is accepted and posts it on social media and buys the T-shirt and is, you know, ready to go. And so that's certainly really important. And then also conditions, you know, hey, we are able to pay this amount, or we're willing to pay this amount, and therefore this, anything beyond that is on you. Those type of good questions and conversations are critical, because then when the kid goes to visit schools, we're not telling you you can't apply. All we're telling you is, if that financial package comes in and it costs $38,000 all told, and we've told you $21,000 is the max we can pay a year, then we need to make some decisions as a family about what the implications of that would be for you working or taking loans and just having a more transparent, open conversation.
Yeah, and Dan, I'm glad you called, because again, this is a part of the book that we're talking about today, but we have done multiple shows focusing just on paying for college. We've got some links on our website if you want to check those out, nhpr.org/exchange. Again, our number, 1-800-892-6477. Elsie's calling from Concord. Hi, Elsie. Go ahead.
Hi.
So I'm
a senior in high school right now. So college is a really important thing for me. And I just wanted to say that when I was a kid, like growing up, I focused a lot on Ivy League schools. Like I have like logos hung up on my dream board and things like that still. But growing up and actually going into the college admission process, I realized that it's not that important if you go to a big name school, as long as the school that you are applying to and eventually get admitted to has what you need from them into the career that you want to go into, and has produced people in that field who are just as important as people who might go to Harvard or Princeton, as long as, like, get the education that you need matters. It might look flashy, but it's really about what you can afford and what is, like, what you're going into.
So, Elsie, I'm so glad you called, because you're, sounds like you're right in the middle of this. I mean, where are you now?
Yeah.
What's happening right now in your life in terms of this college application process?
Right now, I am applying. Well, I got admitted to my top choice school, University of Rhode Island.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I got, like, a pretty big scholarship. It's a $48,000 four-year total, which is, like, pretty good. And I'm applying to three other colleges as well. I've got admitted into one of them, but I don't think I'm going to go there. But I've gotten a lot of those emails. Like, it's a bombardment, like you said, of just emails from colleges saying I have priority application status and just, like, but none of them really stick out to me at all, except for the ones that I'm, like, actually interested in, because when they send you those emails, it's not really about what you want to do. And so, like, I get emails from places who don't even have the education degree that I want.
Right.
So
this is really interesting. Elsie, congratulations, and thank you for calling. And Rick, in a minute, I want to ask you about, you know, the what she mentioned, that students are looking for colleges, but colleges are also looking for students. But first to you, Brennan, she is right on board with what you have often said. You know, ignore those sort of brand names that everybody knows. Chuck the idea that there is a perfect school for you. What about that?
Yeah, I mean, Elsie, you're singing our song. The thing is, those brand name schools, and like the ones she mentioned, Princeton and Harvard, they're great schools, and students should aim high and think about what is out there for them, but also, like she said, look at the kind of the program level of what kind of things she's interested in studying, and do those schools have that? And this pursuit of the perfect school is such a falsity, right? I mean, there really is no perfect school. And we actually try to move the conversation away from this idea of there's one right fit for students, because the idea of fit can seem so confining. Like, there's, like, you know, if the glove fits, we must acquit, or whatever it was, you know, or, you know, that there's going to be one school that's just ideal for students. And when students go into the experience with that approach, they miss out on so many other opportunities. And like she said, like Elsa said, I mean, there's a lot of considerations in terms of finances and everything else.
Well, Elsie, again, congratulations. It's great to hear from you. And let's talk to Craig calling in from Brookline. Hi, Craig, you're on the air. Welcome to the Exchange. Go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call. Hi, Rick. This is Craig Plummer from Brookline, and I had the good fortune of spending a few days down at Georgia Tech last year with you guys. And I wanted to talk to you both about early decision, early action, and trends in the field, and how you handle, you specifically, Rick, about the early action applicants and the trends that are happening within your school, and also that what you're seeing within other schools, why they're switching from early decision to early action or vice versa, and what advice you might give to students who are listening.
Oh, Craig, I'm so glad you called. And Rick, I have to admit, having one 20-year-old, so he's sort of halfway through his college career, and another one coming up, I find this early decision, early action, I find this terribly confusing. Why do they do this?
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, back to Elsie real quick. I mean, one thing she said that was so important, I hope people will take to heart, is celebrate your wins. When you get in, you know, no matter where it is, it's not just this school or just that school. That is a huge deal. Kids have worked really hard to get admitted to any one place. And I don't want that to pass, that people have applied, they've worked hard to get there, and maybe they already kind of knew because, you know, other people like them have already gotten in, but just celebrate every admit. I think that's a really important message. On early decision and early action, Craig is right, and Craig, good to hear from you. The trend certainly has been recently a shifting applicant pool to early. And we've seen that this at Georgia Tech, and it has been a national trend, as he referenced, to see students applying earlier than, you know, and often you'll have two rounds, early action or early decision, sometimes both, and then also regular decision. You're also right about the fact that it is like alphabet soup these days with all kinds of different plans, and it can be confusing. I think, again, that's important, though, to pause on and say, why is that? And
yeah, what's the benefit?
Yep. Well, a couple of things. First of all, for early decision, that is a binding process. And so the basic dichotomy is if you hear a school saying we have ED, we're early decision plan, that essentially means if we admit you, you are bound to come. And I think recently, we won't get into this too much, but based on a Department of Justice inquiry and suit, early decision, I think, is going to continue to fill larger parts of people's classes because they're trying to lock in revenue and lock in students, so they're not fighting for them as far down into the spring or potentially into the summer as potentially they had been before. The important thing here, though, is sometimes kids or parents see, well, the admit rate is higher in early decision, and therefore we should do that. Well, maybe, but again, remember, that is binding. You are saying this is absolutely my first choice. And I think it's really misplaced when people say, I mean, talk about gaming the system on the opposite side, and I think ill-advised to do so. If that's not really truly, you know, aligned with why you want to go to college and what your goals are, as Elsie mentioned, like the specific program and all of that you understand, then ED really isn't the best choice. For early action, part of this is a shift to schools making their class again so that they have longer, if they put the decision out, let's say in November or December, they have a longer time to court the students before what is now the national deposit deadline of May 1st. And so there's no doubt that that's a trend. Schools are filling a larger portion of their class early. And this is all driven around, you know, Nathan Graw has a book out that describes a lot of the demographics. You've heard this probably a little bit about the declining birth rates that occurred around 2008, 2009, which is going to lead to less students going to college over the course of the next decade. All of that kind of thing is leading schools to make institutional decisions because they're trying to protect their class and ensure that they have the net tuition revenue and all of these kind of things. So his last question was advice. And I think the biggest thing there is, you know, first of all, on ED, only applying if it absolutely is your first choice, not trying to game the system. And then on early action, I guess the biggest thing is trying to get out and visit these schools earlier, probably. I know Brennan doesn't love this.
I've just been waiting.
He's probably
to get
in there nodding his head.
Yeah,
so
and,
go ahead.
And
go
pardon
ahead.
The cynicism, gentlemen, but it sounds like these you know, these items, early decision, early action, work for the school. But what about the student? Yeah. How does this benefit them?
It really, and Rick and I have kind of gone back and forth on this, and I actually wrote a piece for Forbes on this that kind of talks about both Rick and my perspective. But this, it's not necessarily a student-centered policy. It has changed the whole, both early decision and early action have changed the whole kind of timeline of college admission and when students apply. And it has really, in many ways, in my opinion, kind of rendered the senior year of high school somewhat kind of impotent, right? I mean, it is taken away when students learn by December that they're into college. It's kind of taken away a year of high school because they kind of check out. And it does take off some of the pressure for students. But when you see transfer rates in this country, nearly a third of all students are transferring, you have to wonder, is this something that's doing really good things for students?
Oh, that's interesting.
Having them commit so early. Right.
Right. And both of you describe this as a process. And a process isn't, you know, A to B to C. A process is kind of messy and unorganized, and there's conversations and thoughts and feelings, and early decision doesn't seem to allow that sort of more unregulated, slightly chaotic process to unfold.
Right, and we actually try to take the word process out of this and really focus on the college admission experience rather than the college admission process. And early decision and early action can make it more seem like more of a transactional process rather than a meaningful experience.
Well, lots of emails and Facebook comments from our listeners as well. So Gail in Londonderry says, I was in college back in the 80s, so things are obviously different these days, but I distinctly remember my high school guidance counselors discouraging students from applying to, quote, stretch schools. The feeling was applying to colleges that were more likely to accept them would increase the school's college acceptance rates. Wow, Gail. She says, I wonder how many students missed out on attending a school that might have been a really good fit because they were discouraged for this reason. I was lucky, Gail says, that my parents encouraged me to apply to some stretch schools. I ended up going to one, and it was a great experience. I had not thought of this, Brennan, but if the high school guidance counselor encourages everyone to apply to a school that has a 90% acceptance rate, that looks great.
Not necessarily.
No?
I actually have the opposite approach. I think every student should get denied from at least one school.
Because it's a good experience
it's a good
to
experience.
Try and fail.
Right.
And pick yourself up.
And it means they've aimed high, right? And so we do encourage students to have some stretch schools. I mean, I think as we look at the kind of a student's college list, ideally they have one or two schools that kind of are an Uber reach, right? That they are way below profile. And they have two or three schools in the middle, and then two or three schools that are pretty likely they'll be admitted.
Well, here's another Facebook comment that came in before the show. Laura writes, I didn't get rejected from my first choice, but I couldn't afford my first choice. So I ended up at my second choice, where I met my husband freshman year. Laura says, now we're supporting our own kid through this process. Our message, it all works out. Laura, thank you for that comment. After break, we'd love to take more of your comments. What's one thing you wished you knew when you were applying to college? What might be your advice to a young person who is going through this experience right now? You can send your comments in by Facebook, Twitter, or send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. More in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, it's the New Hampshire primary news roundup, including a conversation with Democratic presidential candidate Deval Patrick. You can send us your questions in advance to exchange@nhpr.org, and then join us Friday morning, live at 9. This hour, we're talking with the co-authors of a new book called The Truth About College Admission. They are Rick Clark, Director of Undergraduate Admissions at the Georgia Institute of Technology, and Brennan Barner, Director of College Counseling at the Derryfield School and U.S. Performance Academy. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Another Facebook comment I'd like to share with you guys from Drew, who says, I got into my first choice and was rejected from my safety school. College admissions are weird, Drew says. Drew, thank you for writing. I'm sure a lot of people agree with you. And to you first, Rick, I think you describe college admissions as holistic. That's the term that college admissions directors like you use. So call it weird or holistic. Can you just lift the veil a little bit for us, please?
Sure. Well, yeah, I think weird and holistic are both accurate. I think it speaks back to the previous conversation also around, you know, policies like ED and EA. You know, to your question there, I mean, you know, we set up our timeline and we set up our process around meeting our goals. So we are educators and we do care about students, but anyone sitting in a seat like mine around the country has been told, you know, here's what we need, here's what we're trying to accomplish. And therefore, we need to figure out how we're going to bring students into our applicant pool and make decisions around that. So one of the biggest things people would say is either it's not fair or it's weird. And both are true. And I think that's one of the biggest things that people kind of have to get their head around, or the earlier they get their head around that, the more healthy they can be going through this. Because, you know, I like to take my alma mater, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and they're a great example because they are legislated to take 82% of their students from the state, okay? So if you have a student who applies and they're from, well, since you guys are in New Hampshire, Concord, North Carolina, you know, the kids from Concord, North Carolina, instead of Concord or Concord, New Hampshire, the way that the decision is going to be made is different. So, you know, essentially, you could have a student with lower test scores, lower GPA, less activities outside the classroom, a worse essay. All the things we say are important. All the things we say are holistic. And that kid from Concord, North Carolina, gets in because Chapel Hill is the state flagship, and Chapel Hill is enrolling 82% of their students from the state. Meanwhile, this kid from Concord, New Hampshire, is the valedictorian and basically is about to solve cancer, you know, and has done all, is a translating volunteer at the hospital and doesn't get in. Well, is that fair? No. But does that make sense to me? It absolutely makes sense to me, but it feels weird to that kid, right? Because how is that possible? I got into all these other schools and I didn't get into Chapel Hill. Well, institutional priorities drove that decision. And
so
we talk about this in the book.
Yeah. Give us a little bit more on that. That's really interesting. So, you know, a lot of state schools have to admit, you know, X percent of students from the state. But what other institutional priorities might be at work, Rick, that students and their families have no idea are going on? Like, for example, I think one of the examples you give in the book is there's a new business school dean who really wants to grow the program. Or just give us a sense of what some of those priorities might be.
Sure. I mean, I'll speak to my own experience a little bit. I mean, when I got to Georgia Tech, our undergrad population was 28% female. And what we were hearing from employers is we want more women in some of these engineering, computer science, STEM fields. So the goal has been, listen, respond to corporate America. They want more underrepresented students at the table. They want more women at the table. Well, how can we be part of solving that problem? Well, we're going to then, that's going to dictate how we search for students and message to students. We're going to put a lot more of our resources in terms of our budget behind recruiting those students in. And then it's going to play in all down the line to, you know, achieving that goal. It could be majors, you know, as you said, a new major is created, or conversely, let's say a major is going to collapse. You know, it could be, again, gender related. It could be geographic. You know, one goal of a lot of schools is, a new president comes in and they said, we are going to proliferate our brand. We're no longer going to be just regional. We're going to be national. Well, all of a sudden in 1 year, a student who might have applied before from the Midwest, who, you know, there was just a smaller slice of what they were trying to achieve in their class from that particular part of the country, expands 5% or 7% or whatever the internal goal is. You're right. Externally, people may not know that. And that's why from 1 year to the next, there can be shifts and it is hard to predict. And that's why I think even the term safety school isn't really accurate, because things do change.
Yeah, you don't know. You don't know what those institutional priorities are. I'm smiling while you talk, Rick, because my older boy, being from New Hampshire, one of the schools he applied to was in Oregon, and they said yes, you know, almost instantly. So I could see them going, ooh, Northeast, that sounds good. I have a friend who's also convinced that he got into his first choice school because he played the bassoon. So, you know,
well, and,
go ahead, Brennan.
And importantly, and thankfully, there's a huge discussion and a growing one around college access. And so an institutional priority for a lot of schools is having low-income first-generation students, and having students from rural communities is a really big push right now, which speaks to a lot of New Hampshire. And so those conversations are happening. And I mean, one quote we have in the book is from John Barnhill at Florida State University, which is around holistic admission, is that it means colleges can do whatever they want and not have to tell you why.
Mm. Let's go to another caller. Judith is on the line from Portsmouth. Hi, Judith. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sure.
I heard a comment regarding a high percentage of students who transfer, and I'm wondering if there was an assumption behind that. It sounded as though that was being characterized as a negative thing or as an indication that students were making poor choices initially, or that schools weren't serving their students. And I question that because I think transfer can be an indication of growth on the part of a student to better understand his or her needs. And I also think that very often students are pressured to go to school when they may or may not really be motivated, and as a result, make half-hearted attempts to identify the schools to enroll in as freshmen and are really just not ready.
Yeah.
So I think that we need to look at transfer rates from a couple of different viewpoints, and I wonder what your panelists think about that.
Sure. Judith, thank you so much. Go ahead, Brennan.
Judith, that's a great point. And my point earlier was that early decision and early action in some ways push students to make those decisions.
Kind of what Judith is saying.
Right, what you're saying, but there are so many other aspects that play in terms of affordability. A lot of transfer students are transferring because it's just not financially doable, right? And or there's an issue at home and they're transferring to be back closer to a relative. I mean, there's so many different issues. But yeah, there is this piece of students, and this is why we really encourage students to connect with that why and to think about what they want, because they do feel pressured and they do feel like they're going to a certain college maybe because of expectations. And that all plays into reasons students transfer. And it's not always a bad thing, like you said, that students are transferring because maybe they realize they want to pursue a different field and that's not offered at their college. So there really are so many different reasons. And taking a gap year after, I mean, that's a whole different show, right? That there's real benefit for taking a year off after high school and exploring kind of who you are and what you want before diving right into college.
A couple more Facebook comments. Melinda writes, I did not get into my first choice that I applied to for early decision. I did not even attend the college I originally put a deposit down for. Melinda says, I couldn't get the student loans. I ended up at a community college for my first year and then transferred, as we've been talking about, to my local state college for the rest of my undergraduate degree. Melinda says, best thing that ever happened to me. Loved attending Keene State College. Go Owls. Melinda, I'm glad it worked out for you. One theme that I'm struck by throughout this book, gentlemen, that we haven't really talked about yet, is how much in this book the both of you tell parents basically pull back. Give us a couple examples, Rick, of what you feel constitutes parental over-involvement in this experience. And there are many in this book, by the way.
There are. You know, what I would say is it's a bit of a shift of mentality. So we want parents to be involved, and we encourage that. I mean, this is about staying together, right? And the longer I've done this, and Brennan agrees, like the more we realize family is at the center, and that is the whole thing, you know, that we're emphasizing in the book. But one of the easiest ways I feel like for parents to kind of get a pulse check on this is we kind of call it the pronoun test, you know, which is if you, you know, find yourself often saying things like, you know, our first choice is Vanderbilt, then you might be a little too invested. You know, if you're saying like,
yeah, you're not going to Vanderbilt,
the SAT. Right. You know, we're taking the SAT next week. Then, you know, that could be an indication it's time to just go for a walk and, you know, rethink kind of where you stand in this process. What I believe is that, you know, this kind of idea of, to this point, parents have picked where you live, and that oftentimes dictates where the kid goes to high school. They've picked the house, they've picked the school. Even if it's a private school, they've probably been pretty involved in making that selection. And so what we would encourage families to try to do is take their hands off the wheel a little bit and sort of climb up into the crow's nest and look out. And, you know, the parents sort of shifting from parent to partner in this and saying, look, again, I see, from my experience, I see an iceberg here. I see something that we're concerned with out on the horizon. And so let me give you that information and be part of helping to pick locations that make sense, or, you know, make decisions along the way together. But instead of driving and holding so white knuckled to the wheel, kind of climbing up, giving perspective, looking out, and then being a partner more than a parent, you know, in this process, I think is really important.
Brennan, what are your thoughts there? Examples of parental over-involvement?
Well, I mean, you know, I hear stories from colleagues all over the country about, I mean, right, we could go down the road into the college admission scandal and what parents did.
Oh, yes, varsity blues, and I think we did a show on that after that.
Yeah,
happened.
So, and that's the extreme. You know, whether it's writing their student's essay or encouraging their student to kind of misrepresent themselves on their application, there are ways that parents can overstep. And the tough thing is, it's because we love our children, right? And we want the best for them. And sometimes that can really put blinders on to acting ethically and to doing the right thing. We are, you know, colleges know when a parent's written a student's essay, for example.
I remember you told me that years ago.
Yeah.
College admissions directors know what a 17-year-old voice sounds like.
Right, and what a 45 or 50-year-old voice sounds like, right?
Yeah.
And, I mean, they read countless essays every year. And so they can see right through that. And so it really is about the parents taking a step back and telling their student, you know, I trust you and I love you.
One of the stories about parental involvement that is sprinkled throughout this book, and I was really struck by it, Rick, so I want to ask you, is how many parents tell their kids, you will go to my alma mater. There's so many stories about this in the book, and I'm just struck by that, Rick, I have to say. I mean, your child is a separate individual. He or she is not you. So why do parents think their kids will necessarily thrive at university X, Y, or Z just because they did?
Yeah, and certainly we see this year in and year out. You know, again, most of this is coming from a place of love. And the parent, in whatever case, whatever their alma mater is, like, they loved that experience and it meant so much to them. And as you've said from some of your callers or the people that have written in, like, that's where they met their husband or their wife. That's, you know, where kind of they took a turn on the career they wanted to pursue. It's the network that they have. It, you know, and it holds such a dear place, you know, in their heart. And they love their kid too. And so there's this idea and this conflation of, I want to have that shared experience, or, you know, we've grown up always going to tailgate at these football games, or they've been wearing the onesie of that school since they were a baby. And there's just been this dream, right? And it's again, coming from a really loving place, but it can sometimes be tuning out what they should be hearing from their son or daughter. Now, sometimes the kid really legitimately wants to go there. Different story. But often, and we kind of do laugh about this, I mean, we have had students literally write in their essay or in their supplementary or other parts of the application, like, please don't admit me. And I've worked at a couple of schools. I've seen this multiple times.
Like, my parents are making me apply to Georgia Tech, but
yeah.
I don't want to go
yeah.
there?
That's right.
And, oh, my gosh.
You know, So we hear kids say that to us. I mean, and I'm not just speaking from my own individual experience. I mean, you know, over a beverage, a lot of college admission directors will share pretty hilarious stories about the way that a student has later communicated, look, I had to apply. This is not where I really wanted to go. I'm hoping that you won't admit me so I don't even have to have this conversation, which again speaks to an unhealthy dynamic going on within the family. But, you know, I think that, again, so much of this for parents is, as your callers have been saying, like, it always works out. They don't get into their first choice, and yet, you know, they end up somewhere else and they're thriving. I wish more parents would get out of their local echo chamber and talk to more parents of college students that would tell the stories that we've been hearing this morning, which is, it does work out. I didn't get in, or I couldn't afford it, or, you know, I ended up transferring, and, you know, that is the best thing for me. But parents believe that they have sort of the solution, and sometimes that leads to their alma mater.
So for a young person, Brennan, hearing older people like us say, and our emailers and Facebook commenters, it'll all work out. It's frustrating when you're in that process yourself. You're 17, 18, 19. Maybe you're devastated by a rejection. Maybe you're just overwhelmed by the whole process. What's your message to those people listening beyond trust, relax, it'll all work out? Because it's hard when you're in that space to know that it will work out.
It is hard, but it's to find the moments of success. And like Rick said earlier, celebrate your wins and really focus on the opportunities and the fact that if you're looking at college, you get to do this. This is really exciting.
All right. We will do further shows on the cost of paying for college, the choices between two-year and four-year schools. We've looked at those in the past. You can find links on our website, nhpr.org/exchange. And you can also find more information about our guests and their book, The Truth About College Admission, A Family Guide. Brennan Barnard, it was really great to see you. Thank you for being here. That's Brennan Barnard, Director of College Counseling at the Derryfield School and U.S. Performance Academy. Rick Clark, thank you so much. Enjoy the warm weather down there in Atlanta.
Thanks for having me.
Rick Clark, Director of Undergraduate Admissions at the Georgia Institute of Technology. You're listening to The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.